This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We were in chapter 3, in which Eov deals with his dilemma of the three axioms that are irreconcilable. Hashem being just, Hashem being omnipotent, and Eov being righteous. The one he's willing to compromise on is Hashem's omnipotence. He feels that's the least damaging to compromise on. He's not willing to say that Hashem is unjust. He knows that he's a tzaddik, that he knows by knowledge. So the only one that he can compromise on is, well, yeah, maybe Hashem is just, And maybe I'm a tzaddik, and therefore there are other forces at play. Now that doesn't bring him into idolatry, because he's not suggesting that there are other forces that are at play despite Hashem. What he's saying is that Hashem programmed the world in such a way that things could and would sometimes happen without Hashem's direct involvement in it. So Hashem programs nature, and he programs the constellations, and he programs all sorts of things which then in turn have impact on what occurs, on how things develop. So there is another system at play, although God was the author of that system. The Ribbono Shel Olam designed that system. Nevertheless, once designed, that system operates on its own without any further control by the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what Eov suggests. And in so doing, there are just a few very beautiful things that he says that are worth looking at. In defining death, he says certain things that are important principles in our Hashkofa. If you refer back to the Medroshim at the back of your Eov, and you look at page 1005 there, in, on the right hand column, second last paragraph, Eov says, In verse 19, Eov says, "Kotoin v'godol shomhu." Small people and little people, small people and great people are there, meaning in the world to come. The eved chofshi me'adinov, and the servant is free of his master. And Chazal say, "Omer lei Rabbi Zeir and Rabbi Yirmiya, atu lo yadinan de kotoin v'godol shomhu." What is Eov telling us? Of course we know that in the world to come you've got smaller people and bigger people, they're all up there. Elo, but he's saying something else. Kol hamaktin atzmoi bedivrei Torah ba'olam hazeh, anybody who makes himself small in words of Torah in this world, naaseh godol l'olam habo, becomes great in the world to come. Anybody who understands that whatever his contribution in Torah is, it's small compared to what has to be done to the whole, he becomes great there. And anybody who lived as a slave in this world becomes free in the world to come. This contrast between being small and being big, and being free and being a slave, is very important, and we need to look at Eov's statement and the statement of Chazal not just in terms of two different places. There is a place out there called Olam Habo, and there's a place here called Olam Hazeh, and one spends a certain amount of time in this place, and then you get catapulted miraculously into another place, and there it operates differently. We need to understand that Olam Hazeh and Olam Habo run concurrently, and that one in a sense is living in both worlds at all times. The only thing is that during one's lifetime one is living predominantly in this world, with only a small dimension of Olam Habo, and after death one is living predominantly in that world. And things such as being small and being big, what does it mean by that? Being small is the feeling one has of being overpowered, the feeling one has of being in the presence of something much greater. Almost, there's almost the danger of feeling irrelevant. That's the feeling of smallness. It's a very negative feeling. Feeling like a god, or feeling powerful, feeling potent, feeling big is a very positive feeling. Feeling free is a very positive feeling. Feeling enslaved, obligated, dominated is a very negative feeling. So psychology that doesn't recognize the existence of the second world, that deals only with Olam Hazeh, says clearly a person needs to feel free. Clearly a person needs to feel big. He needs to feel in power of his own life. And so the whole of, or a large part of psychology is developed around the belief and the understanding that feeling small is negative, and feeling free is positive, and feeling enslaved is negative. And psychologists counsel people and write books on how to release oneself of any kind of free feeling of slavery and to get oneself to feel free, and how to release oneself of feeling small and to get oneself to feel big. They might even go so far, that secular psychologists who might be anti-religious would go so far and to say, and religion does the opposite to you. Religion makes you feel small and irrelevant, and religion makes you feel enslaved instead of feeling free. And therefore religion is in fact, some of them will even go far and say, is psychologically destructive. That's taking the argument to its absolute conclusion. What is our answer to it? You will sometimes hear the answer given, no, it's good to be enslaved, it's good to feel a slave, and it's good to feel small. In which case we would have psychology and Torah at complete loggerheads, preaching the total opposite. Which, it's possible, it's feasible, that's not a problem in itself. But that's not the Torah view. You see from this medrash that the Torah view is also just the same as the psychologists. It is good to feel free. It's not good to feel enslaved. It is good to feel big. It's not good to feel small. For Horaya, the proof is that in Olam Hazeh, in Olam Habo, in the Olam HaEmes, in the world of truth, that's how we feel. Hashem wants us to feel free, and He wants us to feel big. The problem is that you can't get there without going through Olam Hazeh, which means you cannot achieve freedom without going through slavery. You cannot achieve bigness without going through smallness. And that's something we should really know. It's a very simple thing when you think of it. You can't become an adult until you've been a child. And you cannot experience liberation until you've been enslaved. That's what Pesach's all about. There's no way you can appreciate freedom. There's no way you can relate to freedom. In fact, if slavery doesn't exist, freedom doesn't exist. Freedom is the absence of slavery. And if you have not experienced slavery, you cannot experience freedom. We've spoken several times, I don't remember if in this shiur, or in the other shiurim, we've spoken several times about the human condition thriving in contrast. Our emotions come into play when we're moving, when there's dynamics. When one's static, there are no emotions. You cannot feel, the example I always give is the feeling of acceleration. When an aeroplane starts belting down the runway, you feel the exhilaration of the acceleration. How fast is it going? It's going 200 kilometers an hour. 250 kilometers an hour, then it lifts up. And you can still feel it's going faster and faster. You can feel the thrust. Comes the point where it's going 600, 700 kilometers an hour, then it feels stationary. But it's not stationary. It's going much faster. It's going nearly three times as fast as it was on the ground when you were feeling the exhilaration. You weren't feeling speed. You can't feel speed. All you can feel is acceleration. You can feel change in speed. You can feel when a thing is going faster, and you can feel it when it's going slower. But you can't feel speed. When a satellite belts around the earth at I don't know how many kilometers an hour, you can't feel it. Feel stationary. You don't experience speed. You only experience change of speed. When you're in an elevator going up or going down, you only feel when it changes the rate at which it's going up or down. Once it settles into a rate, you don't feel it anymore. We feel change. We don't feel things that are static. And it's quite tragic that as human beings we tend to resist change. And that's the difference between growing human beings and stagnant human beings. Growing human beings resist change. And dynamic human beings, stagnant human beings resist change. And growing human beings accept and thrive on change. They're challenged by change. It's part of their life. That's what they feel. That's when they feel alive. And the fact that that's when they feel alive is very, very important. Because if you're thriving in change and you're feeling alive, there's a whole section of the Yetzer Hara that doesn't need to come into play. The Yetzer Hara is a desperate attempt to convince yourself that you're actually alive. So one indulges oneself in all sorts of pleasures to bring about changed sensations, to bring about different experiences. And all the funny things that people get up to is in order to feel alive. Why do they need it? Because they don't feel alive. Why don't they feel alive? Because they're in a rut. They're stagnant. They don't feel the movement. There's so many images of this. If we go back to the aeroplane image, when the aeroplane is moving fast, when it's accelerating and it's going up, people don't feel like eating. Not only don't they feel like eating because they might get sick, that's only part of it. Even if it's not because of that, you're actually taken up. You feel the exhilaration of that movement. There's something in it. People like that feeling. They call it speed, but it's not speed. There's something that makes you feel satisfied. Once it settles into its cruising altitude and speed, now you need something else to keep you busy. And you'll notice people don't read when the aeroplane's taking off. They don't do anything. They just sit and enjoy it. You look around and watch people in an aeroplane. I don't know why people don't watch people more. There's nothing more interesting than you go and waste an opportunity of sitting in an aeroplane reading when you could be watching people. It's quite amazing. There's nothing more interesting. You go and read a book about people. Why should you read a book about people when you've got the real people right next to you? You don't have to read a book about them. You can look at them right there. You can study them. And you see that when the plane is taking off, and when the plane is doing something, people don't feel the need to be doing something else. When the plane settles, now they start getting fidgety. And they start standing up, and they sit down to an LL plane, and you already start seeing that, with their safety belts, and they're wandering, pacing up and down, and looking, turning around, facing the back, to get a minion together. They've got to start getting active. They get fidgety. But even if it's not an LL plane, they start getting fidgety at that time. Then drinks become important. They need to smoke. They need to have something to eat. They're bored. But they're not bored when things are happening. And we need to feel that things are happening, and the way we feel that things are happening is through change. That's growth. And so to become free, we need to go through that change. We need to go from slavery to liberation. To become big, we need to grow up. We need to go from being children into being adults. You can't experience adulthood without having experienced childhood. And that change is something that is required not as only a once in a lifetime. It's not only that once in history you go through slavery. We have a Pesach every year. It needs to be reinforced over and over again. It's not just that you have childhood once and then you experience adulthood. You do it over and over again. There are things that we do that revive a sense of childhood in us, a sense of smallness, a sense of needing to be protected, and a sense of sometimes the fear of domination and feeling overpowered. And then we're able to release ourselves from that and grasp control over ourselves and feel us achieving adulthood, feeling ourselves achieving adulthood. That's a very exhilarating feeling. It's the move from childhood to adulthood. It's not just the one. And that's what this medrash means. And that's what Eiv is saying. You need to go through a phase of making yourself small vis-a-vis Torah, to be able to feel your smallness. And then, then you're able to break out into bigness. In Olam Haba, and again, it doesn't mean only in the sense of after 120 years when you get to Olam Haba, then you will feel it if you've gone through this process. It's almost a daily thing. That it's almost an instantaneous thing, that at one and the same moment, while you are making yourself small here, simultaneously you are able to experience a spiritual growth which gives you the sensation of becoming an adult. Simultaneously. And that's what we need to understand. That it is good to feel big, but to feel big you need to, the process is feeling small first. It is good to feel free, but the process is to break out into freedom. The process is not just to be free, the process is to become free. That's what makes it exciting. That's what makes it exhilarating. And we need to do that constantly over and over again. And that Midrash goes on with another way of understanding Eved Chofshi Me'adoinov, and there you'll find a slave free from his master. For Odom Bechayov, when a man is alive, who Eved LeYitzroi UleYitzroi, he is a slave to his Yetzer and to Hashem. He's a slave to his nature and to God's instructions. Uveshor Shu Oyser Ritzoin Yitzroi, if he does God's will, Umachis Yitzroi, he angers his nature. Vechein Lehefech, and the other way around. Mace, when he dies, Yotzol Lechevus. when he dies, he breaks out into freedom. That is the ultimate breaking out, the ultimate liberation. It's an interesting attitude to death, and that's why Eve is able to crave death. He's not doing it just as an escape from his suffering. But he's saying, until now, I didn't feel what slavery was. Until now, I didn't feel the pressures of life. I had an easy life. So I could never appreciate death as an act of liberation. To me, death was always something to avoid. To me, death was always something to be scared about. Now that I see what life is all about, I understand what death is all about. Death is an act of liberation. That's the first time that the soul is totally free of this tremendous tormenting dilemma in which he finds himself throughout his life. There isn't a moment during which we are not subject to that dilemma. There's not a moment during which we don't find ourselves having to make a choice to either anger Hashem or to anger ourselves in some way or another. Constantly having to make that choice. And it's only in death that the neshama is able to break out and to find itself in a situation where it doesn't have to make such choices. And Eve says, that's what I now crave for. I've come to the point of craving that state of not having to make those decisions and that choice. And then he goes on to say, if you look back in your text in Eve, a very pathetic phrase, a sentence in verse 21, Chof Aleph. Okay, it's opposite page 829. Hamechakim lamoves ve'inenu. Says Eve, I think of people who wait for death and it eludes them. What kind of people wait for death? People like me, says Eve, who are suffering a terrible life. But there are people who've suffered it all their lives. I've just had it now for the first time. But there are people who've started off, who've gone through their entire lives without suffering, to the point where they've actually craved death. Hamechakim lamoves, they wait for death. And we now understand what that means. They're waiting for that moment of liberation. Ve'enenu, and death refuses to come. It won't let them away from their suffering. Vayach peruhu, and these people, afflicted with terrible poverty, waiting for their day of death. One day, vayach peruhu, they're digging in their gardens, matmoinim, and in their garden they suddenly find a treasure chest. And they see the possibility, there's a glimpse in front of them of the possibility of liberation without death. Now they might be able to live in good fortune, they might be able to live in wealth. And they see this treasure chest, Vayach Peruhu, and they find themselves buried under the ruins. The sand that they dug out falls over them and they're killed on the spot. That's the cruelty of life, says Eve. You can have a person who craves death, and the moment he sees the possibility of liberation, that's when death comes. That's how cruel it is. And why wait for that, says Eve? I want my death now. I'm ready to die. There's nothing to live for. And there is no point in this life. And then he says at the end, Ki fochad pochadati vayeesoyeni v'asher yogurti yovoili. For the thing which I feared has come upon me, and that which I was afraid of has come. Loi sholavti v'loi shokatati v'loi nochti v'yover roiges. I had no tranquility, I had no rest, and I had no quiet. V'yover roiges, and the suffering has come. What is he saying here at the end of chapter 3? He's saying, I feared all my life that this was going to happen. And that is a very important insight into Eve's personality. I feared all my life that this was going to happen. Why does he say it? He says it for two reasons. Number one, he's saying, don't suspect that this happened because I didn't take the necessary measures to protect myself. I did. I did what I was supposed to do. I took all the necessary measures. I was wise in the way I invested money, how I looked after my children, and I did whatever should be done, because I always knew this was a possibility. I was never careless. I never took it for granted. That's the one thing he's saying. So we can't blame it on anything that I did carelessly. It was clearly an act of God. The other thing he's saying is that I'm convinced that this was my lot, because there is a belief among the astrologers, the Malbim mentions this, that if you are destined to something, you are subconsciously aware of it all the time. And Eev says, I lived with this kind of awareness. I always knew. You know, people often say that. Something in me knew. I've always known this was going to happen. Sometimes it's nonsense. People just say it after the event. But sometimes it's true. There is something inside a person who says, I always knew that this was a possibility. And he's saying that to reinforce his belief that this was astrologically determined and was totally beyond his or God's control. This was inevitable. He's taking a fatalistic attitude in order to protect his sanity and his belief. To protect my sanity that I know I am righteous, and I know that God was righteous too, I must believe that there is a fatalistic power outside the realm of God's decision-making system, of God's hashgacha. But the Medrash sees something else here that is a little disturbing, or introduces us to something disturbing. If you look back on that same page of Medrash, it's page 1005, the bottom paragraph in the right-hand column, Ki pochad pachadati, havu talmide. This is from a piece of Gemara in Brochus. There was a Talmud, there was a young man. Dehava azil basre de Rabbi Yishmael ber Rabbi Yosi. He was walking behind Rabbi Yishmael ber Rabbi Yosi. Chazye de ko mefached. He saw that he was scared, he was nervous. Omale, he said to him, Chato'at, you're a sinner. You're obviously a sinner. Dichtiv, because it says, Pachadu b'tziyun chato'im. Sinners will be afraid in Zion. So what is he saying? The fact that you are afraid means there's something wrong with you. Omale, so the Talmud answered, Hoksiv, Ashrei Adam Mefached Talmud, but there's another posuk, you know, there's a posuk that says, happy is the man who's always scared. Happy is the man who's always nervous. Omale, he said to him, Ho b'divre toiroksiv. That fear is only referring to the fear of forgetting Torah or making a mistake when you're learning Torah. That's the kind of fear that you need to have then. Not the fear of events. It's the fear of your intellectual understanding and grasp of Torah. That's the thing you're allowed to be scared of. Now this is very interesting because this also creates an image of what a frum person is supposed to be, of what a tzaddik is supposed to be. There's got to be an air of fearlessness about him, a measure of fearlessness. And one finds that. I often ask people to look around at the pictures of the gedolim that we've got hanging on the wall, because there's good reason for them to be hanging on the wall. They show us at least what the face of a tzaddik is supposed to look like. And you'll find, if you look around the ones on the wall, without one single exception, you will find that there are a few things they have in common. But one of them is an atmosphere of fearlessness. They don't strike one as being particularly nervous people. Do you notice? So turn around and have a look at them. You see them? None of them strike one as being nervous. None of them strike one as being scared, being afraid. They're all fearless. They're absolutely fearless. And that's part of the middah of a tzaddik. Now, if you look at... It's one of the disturbing things, I think, among a lot of people today. If you look at frum people today, you don't see that. You do with the great people, but with the ordinary people, you don't see that. If I were to say, does a sense of fearlessness describe the typical frum person learning in yeshiva, young boy, young man? Does the feeling of fearlessness, is that the feeling that you would associate with him, or do you get the feeling that you're dealing with a very nervy person? Person is very worried, very nervous, very concerned. Which is the closer one? It's chatorat. You're nervous, you're scared. There's something wrong, you're a sinner. What are you scared of? In the same story, Yehuda b'Rabbi Noson, Havi Ka'azul Basre, the Rav Hamnuna, Chazi, the Kamavis. Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Noson was walking behind Rav Hamnuna and he saw him, he got a shock. He jumped, he caught a fright. I suppose something jerked out at him, he caught a fright. Are you looking to bring Torahs to yourself? Are you looking for trouble? Because it says, and he quotes the verse from our chapter, Ki pochad pochadati vaye etalyoni. I feared this, and it came upon me. In other words, he's learning, Eov is making a statement as if he's almost saying, my fear of it caused it. And he's saying, you're acting scared. Are you looking for trouble? It's interesting. There was once a family in the shul. Amazing people, very, very fine people. But there was one funny thing about these people. They used to walk around with their hospital registration. Every child was registered at the hospital, just in case, so that they wouldn't have to stand in a queue if they got to hospital, and their registration was kept current. So there would be a file open and ready. And they used to walk around with their hospital registration in their pockets, or the whole family, just in case something would happen. You wouldn't have to go back and fetch it. They could be taken right away, just in case. So you would say to yourself, but that's a bit meshuggah, that's going a bit far. The funny thing is, this family needed it, because every second week somebody was in hospital. Which is the cause and which is the effect? There's such a pochad pochadati. What does Eiv say here? Ki pochad pochadati vayeetzoyeni, because I had the fear and it came upon me. And here he says, the Medrash says, the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Ben Noson says to Rav Amnuna, you're scared, are you looking for tzoros? One isn't scared because they are tzoros. The tzoros come because you're scared. It attracts the tzoros. So he also says, Amale v'ksiv ashri odom mefached tzoros. It says, a person happy is a man who's always scared. Amale ha'ba divrei tzoros ksiv. The only thing you're permitted to be scared about is Torah. Making a mistake in Torah, forgetting Torah. That's the only thing you're permitted to be scared about. There's nothing else to be scared about. Tana Rabbonin, the Gemara goes on, we learnt. Maise behilil hazokin. There was a case with Hilil hazokin. Shehoyo mahalech bederich, he was going by the way. Veshoma kul tzavocho beir. And as he came close to the city, he heard terrible shouts coming out of the town. Omar, he said in a very relaxed tone, Muvtach ani she'en ze betoch besi. I know that it's not from my home, it's not one of my family that's in trouble. I know. Olov hakosuv oimer, about him the Torah says, Mishmua ro lo yiro, nochin liboi batuach b'ashem. From bad news he will not fear, his heart is rested, is clear in trust of Hashem. Now what does that mean? That we're meant to believe that nothing bad can ever happen? What does this really mean? Omar Rova says, Haikro Mireshe Lesefe Medrish Lumisefe Lereshe Medrish. If you're looking at which is the cause and which is the effect, you can learn it forwards and backwards. Because this verse has two sides to it. The one part is, I don't fear bad news. The other part is, I trust in God. So let's try it both ways. My time a Mishmura Lo Yiro. Why is it that I don't fear bad news? Mishum denochin libo b'tzach b'ashem, because I trust in God. U'misefe l'resha medrash, but it can be learnt the other way around as well. My time abatuach b'ashem. How come I can trust in God? Because mishmu erol lo yiro, because I'm not afraid of bad news. That's an interesting concept. That means you first have to overcome your fears, then you can trust in God. Just trusting in God as a means of escaping fear, that's not trusting God either. First you have to overcome your fears, and when you have no fears, you can trust in the Ribono Shel Olam. And why should you have no fears? Because bad things can only happen if something's wrong with me. If something's wrong with me, this is theoretical, obviously, thanks. It's not something that's very easy to live with practically for ordinary people. But theoretically, if something's wrong with me, then I must fix it. I must do tshuva. If I know what it is, I can fix it. If I don't know what it is, I'm not held responsible for it. But there's no reason to go around in a state of fear. And here we really see what the definition of bitochen is. Bitochen is relaxation. That's what bitochen is. A person who is able to be relaxed can have bitochen. There's no such thing as a nervy person having bitochen. And we've said often, and I'll say it again, that bitochen does not mean that you can know what the outcome of events will be. All you can know is that whatever will happen is the best thing. It's the best that can be. And then you relax, there's nothing more to worry about. One of the techniques that I remember Dale Carnegie suggests to cope with stress is settle with the worst. Figure out what's the worst that can happen. The first thing is just figure out what is the real worst that can happen, and make peace with that. You can handle that too. And then sit back and relax. Once you've settled with the worst, there's nothing more to worry about. Bitochen is that. Bitochen is being able to say, I can handle the worst. because it comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Not because I don't expect that there'll be anything evil, but that one has to be a tzaddik gomer like Hillel HaZaken. It has to be a tzaddik gomer to know it can't be from my house, there can be nothing evil. But if something is handed to me by Hashem, I know I can deal with it. I can't handle something that maybe came to me from some other source, because who says I can handle it? But if Hashem gives it to me, I know I can handle it. It's like a teacher gives a problem to a student to solve. The student has to start with the assumption that the teacher wouldn't have given it to me if I don't have the tools with which to solve it. What teacher would do such a thing? Give me the problem before he's taught me how to approach it. So clearly the problem he's given me, for I have the tools with which to solve it. That already makes the problem, it takes away 50% of the difficulty of the problem. When you know before you start that you have the ability and the tools to solve it, you don't have to start thinking of anything beyond what you've got. And so it is, if the Ribbono Shel Olam hands us a tzora, if he hands us something difficult, we start off with the knowledge, I know I can handle it because he wouldn't have given it to me if I couldn't. That's where you start. Once you've got to that point, you've got pretty far down the road already in being able to relax. Say, okay, now that I know I can handle it, I've just got to work out how to handle it. That's all. I've got to solve the problem. It's not a question of something that can destroy me. I've just got to solve the problem. I've got to find the formula. I've got to find the way of handling it. But a formula there is, otherwise Hashem wouldn't have given it to me. That's bitochen. Bitochen is being able to be relaxed. And the important thing in this chazal is that it's not that you have to first develop bitochen, you first trust in God, and then you can become relaxed. It works the other way too. It works both ways. You have to develop the ability to relax, take it easy. It's not... things can be dealt with. And then one can develop bitochen, because bitochen can only come in a state of relaxation. You cannot have bitochen when you're panicking. You cannot have bitochen when the adrenaline's going. You cannot have bitochen when you're angry. You can only have bitochen when you relax. So you have to learn how to relax first, then you can have bitochen. And this nervousness, this fear, this neurosis, that's not something which goes with Yiddishkeit. And people who are that way, people who become neurotic with their Yiddishkeit, they were neurotic before they became frum too. They might not have shown it quite as much because they didn't have so perfect a field in which to demonstrate it. If you want to be neurotic, there's nothing as delicious as Yiddishkeit to really indulge in it to the full. You can be neurotic every moment of the day with Yiddishkeit. And I believe that neurotic people tend towards Yiddishkeit because it gives them the opportunity to express their neurosis and to justify it. And if you criticize them for neurotic, they call you an apikuris. So they always feel self-satisfied about the fact that they are neurotic and justified, and they feel religious about the fact that they're neurotic. It's not the Yiddishkeit that made them neurotic. They were neurotic to start with. Yiddishkeit should do the opposite. Yiddishkeit should be able to remove the neurosis, it should be able to remove the tensions, and enable a person to feel far more relaxed and satisfied and understanding of himself and of the challenges that Hashem brings his way, in the knowledge that he can deal with those challenges and that he can handle them. And that's this chazal here. But in opening this window to us, chazal are indicating a possible flaw in Eve's character. If chazal are saying here these few cases, if you're sinning you must be scared, what are they saying? The fear that Eve always lived in, which we never knew about before, he's only acknowledged it now for the first time. He might not have known about it himself. As we said, sometimes something happens to you and you say, and then you say, I always knew this could happen. But if you ask yourself 6 months ago, did you really know? Did you really acknowledge that you had this fear? Sometimes we don't even know the fear that we've got. Later on you say, I've always been afraid of this. Eve now for the first time acknowledges that he lived in fear all his life. That fear, Chazal are telling us, is a possible symptom of a flaw in his character. So the axiom that he is perfect might no longer stand. In other words, in this admission we might find the beginning of the resolution to Eve's dilemma. And that's what Eliphaz hones in on. In chapter 4, Eliphaz is now the first of the three friends who begins to speak. Eve has opened up, and we discussed last time that when you go to comfort somebody, it's the person, that's the mourner who has to open up. Eve has opened up, and he's opened up far. He's actually said a lot. He's let off a lot of steam and a lot of anger. He has lay the blame at the foot of an impotent God almost, a Ribbono Shel Olam who created a system beyond himself, and he has acknowledged the fact that he had fear himself, that he also had fear. And Eliphaz, his argument is founded on the fact that we cannot accept that God is not omnipotent. We cannot accept that there is any force in the world beyond God's hashgacha, that God's hashgacha, that God's attention doesn't reach. There is no such force. And therefore we cannot accept that this is fate, that this was fated to happen, and this was inevitable. We cannot accept the inevitability theory, which Eov is proposing, which means we must say God did it to him. And if God did it to him, and God is omnipotent, and God is just, and nobody's arguing God's justice yet, that we're still accepting, so if we're going to say God is just, and God is omnipotent, and there is no force beyond the boundaries of the Ribbono Shel Olam, then says Eliphaz, I'm regrettably led to the conclusion that there must be something flawed in your character. And it's true that you're not such a Rosho that you deserve all this. You might say, okay, but if there's something flawed in my character, something small, that might be so. There can be all sorts of reasons why this happens, but you can't start with an axiom that you're flawless. That's the important thing to do. And he says to him, he starts with a bit of sarcasm, Eliphaz. Vayan Eliphaz ha-Temani vayomer, and Eliphaz, the man from Teman, answers and says, Haniso dover elecho sile va'atzer b'milin miyucho. There are different ways of taking the first part of that sentence. You'll see how your English takes it. If one ventures a word to thee, will you be grieved? In other words, I'm going to say something harsh. Are you going to get upset with me? That's the one way of taking it. But the way that the Beforshim take it is different. Let me see where it's put succinctly. No, the Tzudas David puts it very clearly. Ha'im ro'uy v'nochoin, is it correct? Shekasher menaseh oischo bedover ro'o min aroyis naaseh so miyad ayefi yageh meliyeis maksik betumecho betumosecho? Is it fair that the moment Hashem brings a harshness on you, you immediately give up your perfection, you give up your tzidkus? It's true, it's been rough years, but it's only just started. You've had a very good life. And is it right that in a short period of suffering you should so quickly give up your righteousness? Has anything bad happened to you before? It's just happened now for the first time. So you must understand, it's very hard to withhold oneself from reacting. It makes me angry, Eliphaz. Now we're going to watch techniques in dealing with people as well in this whole Eov and his three friends discussion. And here we see the first technique being used, which is, instead of what we would normally tend to do when Eov starts complaining and how miserable it is and how he's suffering and it must be because he was fated to, and the day he was born shouldn't have happened, and he would rather have death, and it's so much better in Olam Habo, and he worried about this all his life, oh poor Eov, the tendency would be to say, yes, poor Eov, you're right, it's terrible, never. What does that achieve? What does one really achieve with that? If you want to just support the person to identify with him, you just have to keep quiet. Don't say anything. And then he feels your support. By agreeing with him, you're reinforcing his self-centeredness, his inwardness. You're reinforcing his negativism. What are you really achieving? And then to say to him, hey, Yev, it's not really so bad, come on, old boy. That's also from completely, he'll make that irrelevant. That means you don't understand me. So Eliphaz chooses a very interesting technique. He gets angry. He says, what right have you got to do so much complaining? It's a short period of your life that you've had the tzoras for. What right have you got to do so much complaining? That anger is very interesting. Because that means Eov has got to start defending himself. That means an argument is set up. That means reasoning is going to take place. He's going to deal with problems, not just push them aside. And Eliphaz is becoming a very, very skilled counselor. He's challenging Eov in a way that a counselor needs to challenge him. He's not accepting what Eov is saying. In the midst of Eov's tzoras, He's challenging him and he's saying, what right have you? I can't hold myself back anymore. I can't stand hearing this nonsense. What right have you got to complain? Now, in saying that also, he's saying something else. What do you mean, what right have he got to complain? He's just lost his entire family and all his wealth and his health. What do you mean, what right have you got to complain? So what is there implied in Eliphaz's statement? You can start again. Life's not over. You don't have a family, you can start again. You don't have a business, you can start again. It can be done. We don't see it so much in this country, because most of the Jews in this country came here before the war. Nearly all the Jews in this country came here before the war. But in other places, particularly I'm thinking of the States, you see Jews who came after the war, who suffered unbelievably. You see Jews there who lost everything they had, who lost their entire families, their parents, their children, their wives, their money, everything. And you walk into their homes, and what do you find? Something in particular with Hasidic even. What do you find? Simcha, you find joy, you find wealth, you find brocha, you find big families. And you look at this man and you say, he might be a man now, I suppose, let's say he's a man in his of 70. I'm thinking back 10 or 20 years ago. So that would have been in the 1970. That's how many years after the war? That's 30 years. That's 25 years after the war. So he could have been a man in his 55, 60. Which means that he came to America after the war at the age of 35, 40. With nothing. Nothing. Not a penny and not a relative. And you think to yourself, all very well now, looking at him at 1970 or 1980, but turn the clock back and think to yourself, what was this man when he came and what did he do about it? Did he sit and say, oi, 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 what a terrible life I've had? Or did he start again? And look what he built up. One time with the Ponovizhirov, that was the whole unbelievable story of the Ponovizhirov, how by chance he was out of Lithuania on government business when Lithuania was invaded. He was in Switzerland on his way to America, and in Switzerland he heard that his family had been wiped out and that there was no point in going to America because the purpose of his mission was no longer applicable. He was going to go to America on behalf of the Lithuanian government to get America to increase its quota of Lithuanian Jews. And so there was no point in going. The Jews were killed. So what did he do? Sit down and cry? He changed route and went to Israel instead. Started a new family, started a new yeshiva, started a whole Torah movement, revitalized. The whole yeshiva movement that we've got in Eretz Israel today was built on the shoulders of the Ponovizhirov. But he was already a man, he must have been at least 40, who had lost everything and started from absolute scratch, absolute beginning again. And off he goes, and he does it, he manages. The human being is very resilient. He's capable of being very resilient. There are certain people who refuse to start again. They refuse to start a day again. When they wake up in the morning, it's a continuation of the previous day. If they had aches and pains yesterday, they will insist on remembering the aches and pains before they get out of bed. If they had tzoros yesterday, they'll remind themselves of their tzoros today. If they were tired yesterday, they'll remind themselves of how tired they were yesterday before they get up. They'll start their day deeply rooted in the negativisms of yesterday. They refuse to start again. They hang on to their difficult past as if it's absolute vital, it's a lifeline for them in some weird sort of way. People who refuse to start again. And those same people, if they have an argument with somebody, they'll never forget the argument. And if they're offended by somebody, they'll never forget the offense. And if somebody lets them down, they'll never forget that person lets them down. It's the kind of person who just will not let go of the past. And that's a person who never heals. That's the person who gets sick. He gets sick emotionally, he gets sick spiritually, and he probably gets sick physically as well. He's a sick kind of a person. He has a tendency to sickness. And you have other people who can let go of the past. They can move forward. But again, it's that question of change, of growth, of thriving on change. Good, I've hit the bottom. It's bad. I've lost everything. No, today we start again. That's how we work. It's a different kind of human being. It's a different kind of person. And that implied in Eliphaz's anger. It's only just happened. It's not as if it's been going on for years and years. You've had sorrows, fine. Everything's wiped out. Okay, start again. Get busy. What are you sitting moaning about?
And in that anger, Eliphaz already holds out a ray of sunlight for Eve. And then he says sarcastically, you have given Musa to a lot of people. Eve, you've been wonderful. I must say, he says to Eve, you've taught so many people such a good lesson. And you have strengthened weakened hands. People who have become weak in their belief have now become strong. Koshel yekimun milecho. People who were weak have been uplifted by you. Uvirkayim koirois to amet. And you have given strength to knees that had buckled. Ki ato tovoi elecho votele. Because now this has come upon you and you have become weary. Tiga odecho vatibohel. It has only touched you and you've started to panic. What does he mean? What is he saying? You've given strength to people and because you've started to panic? He's saying, you know, he is. When the tzoras afflicted you, everybody started asking why. And people were losing their faith. But now you've revealed your true colors. Now you've shown that you weren't a tzaddik at all. Now you've shown the Sotman was right, although we don't know about the Sotman. We, the readers, know, but they don't know about it. But in effect, the Sotman was right. That you were a believer as long as things were going well. But that just begin to touch you, just begin to turn the screws, and you would give up. And by giving up, Eve, you've proved to everybody that God is just, that He only punishes wicked people like you. That's what you've proved. Thank you, Eve, you should care for the wonderful shir. Carry on moaning, carry on groaning, because that simply reaffirms everything we've always known and strengthens our belief that God has punished you because you're wicked. And you're demonstrating your wickedness now. He really launches into quite an attack. But what a brilliant act of counseling to really make Eve confront the issue. That's how Eliphaz hands in. With no kid gloves, he comes right into Eve and gets to the essence and suggests that the flaw is not in God's omnipotence. The flaw is not in God's justice, the flaw is in Eve's righteousness. And while he may have lived as a righteous man all these years, buried deep under that righteousness was an element of expedience. He was righteous to protect his belongings. He was righteous to protect his blessings. But once there's nothing more to lose, once God has removed all that, Eliphaz challenges Eve on the basis that he wasn't a righteous person altogether. And he puts Eve on the defensive instead of on the offensive. Up until now it's been Eve against God. Now Eve is a defendant. And he's going to have to justify himself and look inward and ask himself very honestly whether he is really the righteous person that he considers himself to be. And in this session next week we'll take Eliphaz's argument further.